Hi, this is Paul. The video, the clip from one of the Exodus seminar videos that came out in the second wave is Lust Adultery that came out on Jordan's channel has been causing an uproar. I watched this video by a Roman Catholic on it. What Do You Mean? Did a video on this, and it's interesting. Now, I've been catching up on the Exodus seminar. I haven't quite figured out exactly what to do with it. Like, you know, as you know, I was given a license to use 10 minutes of each episode of the first 8 videos. And I haven't done it partly because when they said that the whole thing is coming out on YouTube in April, it's like, I'd rather have a little bit more license. And they're clearly allowing people to use the clips for other clips in conversation, which I think is very smart, because smart for Daily Wire, because the more it gets talked about, the more it gets played, it just helps them. But it very much got into some of the issues that I've been talking about in my adult Sunday school class. So let's jump into this clip.
I'm less interested in the interior person, morally speaking, than you are, probably any of you are. And it's largely, I do believe, because I come from a behaviorist, law-based religion. We care how you act. That's why we don't have a claim that if you look at another woman with lust, it's as if you've committed adultery with her. I am, as I said yesterday, I thank God for America's Christians. And Maimonides said, if it weren't for Christians, the world wouldn't know about the Torah. So I'm a big Christian fan. But obviously, Christianity and Judaism are not identical religions. And we have no equivalent that if you look upon another woman with lust, it's as if you have committed adultery with your heart.
Now, this obviously is going to go somewhere when he says something like this, and other people have pulled out other Dennis Prager quotes, but it gets into what I was talking about in my adult Sunday school class with respect to Paul, because these issues are very much in play. Now, in all fairness to my Jewish friends who will repeatedly tell me that Dennis Prager doesn't speak for all of Judaism, the Jews don't have a pope in the same way the Roman Catholic Church has a pope, as if this pope spoke for all Roman Catholics. Now, I'm planning on releasing this video on Wednesday morning. Tuesday, my schedule is all full up, so I'm not going to have a chance to make any videos probably Tuesday, so I'm making this on Monday. But this very much is part of what the Apostle Paul is dealing with and where Christians get this from the book of Romans.
Paul begins to notice something about sin with coveting, that there's something deep in Paul's heart that stands against God and his neighbor. And I think partly because of our long history of civilization and our long history with these texts, we can't not see it. On one level, let's say you imagine the tree in the garden, and you have the snake, and you have the man, and you have the woman.
I clearly am not Jonathan Peugeot.
And they're looking at the tree, and they're looking at the fruit. And on one level, let's say you knew nothing about human beings. You had never met one, or these are somehow creatures that you have no experience with. All you knew was that there was a rule, and that rule said, these things here on the tree should not go into their mouth. So you're watching. You see these things moving around, and then you see, whoop, whoop, bang. Hey, violated the rule. And on one level, that's what the story's about. The story's about, don't take the fruit from the tree and put it in your mouth. We didn't stop there, though, because when we look at the man and the woman and the serpent and the tree, we start mind reading. And in fact, it's in the text, because not only when it says very clearly, the woman looks and she sees that the fruit was good for eating. She begins to covet. In other words, Paul says something happens with the law that I begin to notice something like the rich young ruler that Jesus talks to. I can't really stay clear of this law just by not cooking a goat for Elon Musk, not ignoring my parents, avoiding murdering Richard or Jacob, because Jacob's far more annoying than Richard. Avoiding murdering Jacob. I find it fairly easy to avoid murdering people. I don't have a lot of murderous things. Avoid sleeping with women other than my wife. You know, if you kind of keep your clothes on and stay out of bed, and, you know, that's manageable for most people. Stealing, you know, that's there's a phone, you know, maybe I'd like that. That's his phone. I won't touch it. Going to court and making false accusations against Edie. That sounds like kind of a lot of work. I think I won't do that. Okay, but Paul says, but when I get to covet, he's basically pulling in the Sermon on the Mount here. I find law plus rebellion means I'm not that good. And people might look at me and say, he's avoided murdering, he takes care of his parents, he's faithful to his wife, he doesn't take his neighbor's stuff, he doesn't go to court and make charges against them. But I can sit in my house and look at my neighbor's house and just churn and churn and churn and churn and churn. And somebody just watching a silent movie of me would say, he's just sitting there. He's not breaking any laws. That's right. He's not breaking any laws. You can sit and look at your neighbor's house all you want, and the police are not going to come knocking at your door, because you're going to say, I'm just sitting there looking. But Paul says, that covet thing, now suddenly sin has a psychological nature to it.
So let's play Dennis again.
I am less interested in the interior person, morally speaking, than you are, than probably any of you are. And it's largely, I do believe, because I come from a behaviorist, law-based religion. We care how you act. That's why we don't have a claim that if you look at another woman with lust, it's as if you've committed adultery with her. I am, as I said yesterday, I thank God for America's Christians.
And I wonder where he says with, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. That's in the Ten Commandments.
And Maimonides said, if it weren't for Christians, the world wouldn't know about the Torah. So I'm a big Christian fan. But obviously, Christianity and Judaism are not identical religions. And we have no equivalent that if you look upon another woman with lust, it's as if you have committed adultery with your heart. There's only one way to commit adultery in Judaism, and it's with a different organ. And
which is a great line. I mean, Dennis is a fun speaker. But what about covet? I mean, that's the 10th commandment. There it is. It's there for you, just like it's there for us.
I'm not being cute. I'm being very realistic. Looking with lust is not a sin in Judaism.
What's the stance on pornography?
So pornography, when I'm asked this question,
put you on the spot.
You did
way.
Indeed. Okay, so my answer, when it's raised on my radio show, I have a male-female hour, and I'm very open about sexual subjects. I always ask if a wife calls me and says, my husband looks at pornography, I found on his computer. I have one question. How is your life of intimacy with your husband? Is it good? In other words, is the pornography in lieu of you or in addition to you?
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is not a religious answer, and mm-hmm. I'm not even giving a religious answer. I'm giving mm-hmm. what I think is a moral and realistic answer. Men want variety.
And I think that distinction he makes there is very interesting, because it's not a religious answer, it's a moral answer. And so it's a part of where this all goes, and the food fight that it sort of releases onto the world is, you know, very much interesting. Well, maybe we'll play a little bit more of it, and then we'll look at some of the critics.
And if adultery is a substitute for, if pornography is a substitute for one's wife, it's awful. If it's a substitute for adultery, it's not awful. That is my unpredictable answer.
Well, there is a clinical rule of thumb that's akin to that, I would say, if you're trying...
Now, before we get into Jordan's, if it's... Now, when he says it's awful and not awful, well, how does that stand up with sinful or not sinful? See, and this is where a lot of the commentary... Okay, so we're gonna stack up these behaviors that are sin and not sin. Okay, that's a system that you can initiate, but you always have to remember that these systems are always nested in other systems. Okay, so it's sinful. What does that mean? You go to hell? Well, so then you suddenly have Protestants and Catholics talking about, well, how exactly is atonement taken care of? And then you can have, well, so Dennis Prager says it's not a violation of the law. Okay, but then I watch people talk about it, and it's like, okay, well, so now we're going to have this big food fight about whether or not we're going to label it as sin or a violation of the law, but then what did he say? It's terrible?
Substitute for adultery, it's not awful.
Okay, awful versus not awful. What scale is that on? What language universe is that a part of?
That is my unpredictable answer.
Well, there is a clinical rule of thumb that's akin to that, I would say. If you're trying to decide clinically whether someone's partaking in a habit, say use of alcohol, has reached the threshold of clinical significance, one of the things you do is ask the person you're assessing, now, is it interfering with your employment? Has it got you in trouble with the law? Is your family complaining? Does it stop you from doing other things that you should be doing? And so the judgment isn't the use of the forbidden substance itself. It is in some sense consequentialist. And I'm not saying that...
And now that I have heard from many therapists, secular therapists. Christian therapists will tend to have more of a take on it. It was something someone said to me was very interesting. He said, I knew that societal thinking with respect to pornography would change when on Friends, one of the guys on Friends, maybe Joey, they talked about use of pornography as just a normal part of a man's life. And you'll find that in other media. It's funny because you have this debate about media and representation, and in many ways, representation in media does sort of move the Overton window around. You know, similar questions with respect to gambling. Not very long ago in America, churches were very much against gambling. And one of the things that I noticed when I moved out west, where gambling is quite a bit more pervasive, there's less stigma in church with respect to gambling than, say, churches out east.
That's an absolute, but it is a hallmark of clinical judgment.
But Dennis, you're making, I think, too big a gap between, you know, behavior and where it comes from. And surely the 10th commandment is exactly that. You could expound everything.
There we go.
Everything Jesus said from thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife or another woman, you're not whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well,
no, the whole point of coveting, it begins in the heart. And I understand your Hebrew word.
And of course, he's getting this from Paul, as the Christian church has done. And they sort of looked at the covet plus the other table of the law with respect to love your neighbor is a lot of what Jesus points out in the Sermon on the Mount.
Word for covet is a desire that doesn't stop halfway.
Right, to take.
It takes action.
It's to take.
Yeah.
It's not, there's no ban in the 613 laws of the Torah on lusting. I don't even know there's a tava is the closest you could get to lust in Hebrew. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask you about that.
The covet is critical. I can say, I can be attracted to my neighbor's wife. I can't want her. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. Because it. But what about a single woman? I asked one of the great Protestant.
Now there was a little clip that one of the other guys had on this. So this other Catholic guy pulled this one out.
A, not comparing you to them. B, not in any way becoming dissatisfied with you. And C, certainly not thinking of them later. He looks at them because they are other women, whether they are more attractive, just as attractive, or less attractive. They are women in bikinis, so he looks.
If my wife were here.
Now, one of the interesting things that we talked about in the marriage crisis videos has been the impact of evolutionary psychology on these conversations and the recognition that men have a desire for novelty in a sexual area. It's interesting the moral valence that evolutionary psychology takes in these conversations. And you get Dennis Prager. I don't know where he stands with respect to the question of humans' descent from animals. I'm sure someone in the comment section will pull it up. But very interesting the way that work figures in.
Thinkers of our generation in a public debate in Phoenix, I asked them, so can a single Christian male look upon a single woman with lust? He can't be committing adultery. He's not married and she's not married. So is the real ban lust or is the ban on adultery?
Well, you've also got fornication.
Yeah. I mean, at least for me, when I hear all of this from my own Orthodox perspective, it's bewildering because at least from the tradition in which I am, it's not a morality question. Even the word morality, it bothers me. At least in the Christian tradition that I participate in, the call is to be transformed. The call is to be free. That's the call. Christ is calling us to be free. And so the idea of like, can you lust or can't you lust or can you do this or not this? The answer is we have desires in us, and these desires tend to enslave us. They tend to pull us into themselves.
And so if you follow my adult Sunday school class, we'll often raise the word that comes up in the New Testament from Paul as epithumia, which is an over desire. And the question, and so these desires of the heart, often in Pauline literature, it's epithumia. And this is very much what Jonathan is talking about here.
And these laws are exterior ways for you to understand how it is that you can now be free from these desires. None of the desires are wrong. Like sexual desire isn't wrong, desire to eat isn't wrong. None of these things are wrong. The problem is when they capture you.
Mm-hmm. Insubordination.
Right. And so it's not about like trying to figure out if I'm sinning or not sinning. Like if I go to confession, I ask forgiveness for all the sins I've done, voluntary and involuntary. It's like I'm sinning all the time, if you want to know. Like every you know, all day long I'm sinning. But the
that's
idea,
why you're so much fun.
That's why I'm so much fun.
And Jonathan, I was glad Jonathan was here because Jonathan is pretty much articulating my perspective on this.
But the idea is rather that, you know, to attend to my desires in the sense so that I'm not captured by them, so mm-hmm. that I don't become obsessed, so that I don't fall into that. Mm-hmm. So to me, like the question of like legally trying to figure out like where I'm sinning or where I'm not, it's just like it pulls me into a world
if a man has.
Now, then they're going to continue this, but I wanted to jump over because this other guy pulled all these clips from Protestant. So what fascinated me about sort of how YouTube got this, it's like, well, we're gonna get clicks on this sucker. So then he goes after Protestants, he goes after masturbation, then goes after Protestants and looks at some big Protestant YouTubers, looks at, let's see, does he put the links of these things in here? He should. Come on, you should give the links to the videos. And then this guy,
Pastors Alan Parr.
Is this wise? Paul says that all things are lawful for me, but not all things are beneficial or expedient. In other words, what he's saying is there's a lot of things that the Bible doesn't say this is wrong or this is a sin. We can smoke crack, we can sniff cocaine, right? We can text while driving. It doesn't even say that if you're single and you're dating somebody that you can't spend the night with them. But
I don't know if I necessarily, because when people hear those things, they're gonna, you know, text while driving versus doing crack or cocaine.
Any of those things that I just mentioned, wise, will they get us closer to God? And the answer is no, and I would put masturbation in that same category.
Parr also says that lust is wrong, but masturbation apart from lust, well, that just...
Okay, and it's very interesting the way this guy is going to go into distinctions here, and he'll be much more categorical.
And I know this case. I know a man who was saintly in taking care of his Alzheimer's wife, who got Alzheimer's at the young age of 50, and watched over her and bathed her for a decade. And then, so I would just ask, you asked me about pornography. So this man was faithful to a wife with whom he could not have relations, obviously, for a decade or more. I think it went to 15 years. Would he have been wrong in relieving his sexual tension with a photograph?
See, I'm wondering if it's this, Dennis, maybe, and this is something that I had talked to people in my clinical practice about. So imagine there's the, and I guess we're into thou shalt not commit adultery.
Well, let's before we hear from Jordan, part of what I think about too in this is, and again, I'm probably unsurprisingly more where Jonathan Peugeot is at with this sort of delineate. It's helpful to delineate for people norms with respect to even the detailed parts of one's life. And this is the thing that hopefully you have a pastor or a priest or a good Christian community or people around you that can help work through the details of your life. Just tagging sin versus not sin. Again, I'm very much more with Jonathan on this. The goal is, most of my sermons, again, I didn't do it last Sunday. I'm surprised nobody mentioned in the comment section, at least that I saw, misery, deliverance, gratitude, misery, deliverance, gratitude. The goal of this is to become perfect, is to become godly, and we all fall short of the glory of God, and the Christian life is for this. Now, people needing direction on, well, this isn't going to be helpful. Well, this is helpful. You should not be mastered by anything. But it's very interesting. Okay, well they're not naming sins the way they ought to. Okay. Just the way that I watched this play out, especially the Protestant Catholic thing, how that video was sort of like, well, okay, so we in the Catholic Church have it right. Okay. Dennis Prager has his rule-based approach too, and your rules don't agree with his rules.
By the way, which is the next commandment, you can imagine an erotic image that compels sexual desire, and I think that's part of what we're discussing, the morality of that, or its potential to be an implement to the instantiation of an ideal. You can imagine a situation where your desire is to sleep with your neighbor's wife. You're not acting on it. But the reason you're not acting on it is because she doesn't want to sleep with you. Now, it still seems to me that given that your desire is to undertake the act, and the only reason that you're not able to manage it has nothing to do with your moral stance. It has to do with the impossibility of the action. Now, given it's, I don't know how you would deal with that, because
that's a violation of do not covet. He's coveting his neighbor's wife. It's clear as a bell.
Okay.
So it's very interesting to me how we talk about this, how we think about it, and then how we present it in a moment, how we react to one another with respect to ideas such as this. It's also interesting to think about when you go back to Dennis Prager's idea that, well, that marriage is the answer to this. And so in the Christian Reformed Church right now, we're having this fight over the Heidelberg Catechism question and answer 108 that has to do with chastity. And I remember somebody, listening to somebody who knew C.S. Lewis personally, talking about Lewis, talking about the fact that, you know, it wasn't until later in life that Lewis finally believed he had achieved chastity. And then actually after that, he meets this woman and then he gets to marry, and he writes about in A Grief Observed, just intimates how, you know, part of what he never expected to marry, he never expected to have the pleasure and joy of marital sex. And then he was able to, and then of course it was taken away from him. All of this pastorally, what you do when you sit down with someone is, you certainly have this matrix in the back of your mind. You don't tend to have a list of categories. Boy, see, but then it sounds like, well, then you're just on a slippery slope. But this, again, is where I think you go back to the framework of ideals. Because if you have a framework of ideals, then that helps you know better or worse. That isn't to mean you don't need a framework of permissible, not permissible, but once you have, obviously, the category of not permissible, you have to figure out what to do with that not permissible category. And as we're going through Romans 7, this will obviously be a very big deal. And part of what Paul wrestles with then in Romans 7 is that, okay, so there's this relationship between law and sin. And to a degree, when you begin to categorize all of this sin, the rebellion in our hearts, for some of us, more than others, makes us want to transgress. And I was alive once apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin sprang to life and I died. And this commandment, which was to lead to life, was found with respect to me to lead to death. For sin, seizing the opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and through it killed me. So then the law is holy, and the commandment is holy, and righteous and good. Therefore, did what is good become death to me? May it never be. Rather, it was sin, in order that it might be recognized as sin, producing death through what is good for me, in order that sin might become sinful to an extraordinary degree through the commandment. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am fleshly, sold into slavery to sin. Now, this gets super complex, because at this point, people want to know, Paul, are you talking about before your life in Christ or after? And so we'll be talking about this for the next few weeks in our adult Sunday school class, because this is tremendously hard. For what I am doing, I do not understand, because what I want to do, this I do not practice. But what I hate, this I do. But if what I do not want to do, this I do, I agree with the law that is good. But I am no longer the one doing it, but sin that lives in me. For I know that good does not live in me, that is, in my flesh. For the willing is present in me, but the doing of the good is not. For the good that I want to do, I do not do, but the evil that I do not want to do, this I do. Let's hear where they're going to take this.
Here's a point worth making. There's a great gulf between the Ten Commandments and the Christian faith in this way. First of all, by the way, the Ten Commandments are painfully obvious, aren't they? Doesn't everybody know that before the tablets? I had a great teacher. Most of my great teachers were Jews. Dennis will say maybe that's why I know things. But
I wouldn't say that.
I do. But there's a great man. He's dead now. His name is Harry Newman, and he styled himself a nihilist. And we would argue with him about that all the time, and he was a very, very learned man and a great teacher. And so sometimes when you want to put the point that he's a nihilist, he would say, I'm a non-practicing Orthodox Jew. Mm-hmm. And that emphasizes the point that it is a set of practices.
I know someone who's a non-practicing Orthodox Jew.
More than a set of beliefs. Mm-hmm. Whereas Christianity mm-hmm. is more a set of beliefs.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, right there, we're very much into the conversation in this little corner. Is it a set of beliefs? Is it a set of practices? Or maybe is there sort of a transjective situation in which we certainly have beliefs, we certainly have practices, so we have propositional knowledge, we have procedural knowledge, but we also have perspectival knowledge and participatory knowledge. And, you know, when I look at what Paul is wrestling with, this is what he's wrestling with.
These four are beliefs, I mean behaviors, aren't they? And they're pretty mm-hmm. well universal.
Yeah.
Almost all societies would agree with these four, but thou shalt not covet is innovative. Mm-hmm. And I'm intrigued. You have René Girard, as you know, everything based on mimesis. In other words, we desire what other people desire. And I read Girard, the whole of American consumerism is based on mimesis, is it not? We are taught to desire what other people desire. I want to wear what you wear, or mm-hmm.
Well, it's a good way. It is a good way of figuring out what's of value. I mean, because that is an open question. There's many things you could value, and one way of becoming informed about that is to see what everyone else values. And so, I'm trying to strip the morality out of that to some degree. I mean, that can become mm-hmm. that can become weaponized, yeah. and it can become pathological.
But so to go back to Larry's friend, I mean, you know, or Larry's teacher, you've got to, there's got to be, even if you're committing yourself to certain exterior practices or habits or behaviors on the basis of, say, command, there's got to be some prior belief, prior commitment into the authority of the person or the source of these commands. So there's mm-hmm. got to be
well,
some kind of...
Well, one question, now. Question that...
Well, you've got to believe that they're...
Hardly in society, they wouldn't agree with those four.
No, but, well, let's say it doesn't matter where the source of authority might come from. It might be the inner one's conscience, that the nihilist is still going to accept that there is some degree. The nihilist who conforms to these behaviors is going to say, is going to be acting on something, nothing.
I'd like to challenge Larry's supposition, just for the sake of discussion. Are these self-evident? And I would say... They're not exactly self-evident to psychopaths, right? So the self...
Well, and now in many ways we're getting into Romans 1. To what degree is the law, the immediate law, dare I initiate the conversation with respect to natural law, law that can be observed apart from the mediator. In my Sunday school class, those of you who've watched it, I repeat things a lot in my Sunday school class. And if you watch a bunch of my Sunday school class videos, you might say, well, why does he keep repeating some of these illustrations? I do until the people, this is part of the reason I do this in a class, I do it until the people can repeat it back to me. So when I say, what's the illustration I use for righteousness? The cop. What's the illustration I use between immediate law number one and mediated law number two? The mother and the child and the hot stove. I repeat these illustrations again and again and again and again so that with repetition, the members who come to my class, not all of them come every week, I don't have a classroom situation, but bit by bit by bit, they'll get these concepts well seated in their mind, and then we sort of have this framework through which we can at least begin to appropriate the book of Romans.
The evidence argument's a really interesting one because you could add the psychopathy twist to all of these. It would be, well, thou shalt not kill unless you can get away with it. and it works in your favor. The same with adultery, the same with stealing. And the question there would be something like, well, why shouldn't I do this if I can get away with it?
Now, you know what I like about the conversation around that table there? And you know what I don't like necessarily about how the conversation is conducted on YouTube? So fair enough, YouTubers who want to show a hard line, to put up a list of rules, and to say, here are all the rules. All right, guess what? When you're really dealing with people, having some rules can be a good thing. Not going to argue with that at all. And telling people, yeah, you shouldn't use porn, best not to masturbate. Those are fine things to tell people. However, Romans 7 continues to linger. And the goal that you have is to help people along the way, I think, to the point that Jonathan Peugeot was making. The goal on the way is to pastorally help people towards not being, as the other Protestant YouTuber said, not being mastered by these things. And you know, I think this goes all the way back to Augustine. Augustine with his story about the pears. Was it pears? Was it peaches? I think it was pears. That the rebellion sort of welled up in him to grab them. And in my experience, Peterson makes a strong point about sort of the psychological question of, okay, to what degree is this behavior disrupting your life? And that's sort of the addiction test that they use. Is this behavior leading to significant reciprocal narrowing? Okay. So then you get the situation of the people who can manage they're an alcoholic that can manage his alcohol, or with the Jordan Peterson mobster video, or maybe it was Michaela's video with him, where he very much works with anti-gambling, where he says, you know, Michael Jordan has millions of dollars and he can afford his habit, but the high school or college athlete with the gambling problem can't. So there's that. The difficulty is that life is so complex that rule-based systems tend to break down. And there might be absolutely nothing wrong, let's say, with watching basketball. I'll even avoid American football because of the brain injury question. Just basketball. There might be absolutely nothing wrong with watching basketball. But watching basketball can become sinful for you. So, you know, I did not want to make a video like seems like the other big Christian YouTubers did about this issue, because in my pastoral experience, a lot of it has to do with walking with people quietly through whatever it is that is impeding their progress in growing in godliness. And all people fail, all people stumble. You know, this can get into something like the Ravi Zachariah case, who was, you know, seemingly not just committing virtual adultery, but much more like real adultery with other women, et cetera, et cetera. What's the point that I want to make with that? The book of Romans, chapter 1. The Greeks fall short of the law that can be apprehended by careful observance of the world. The Jews were given, the children of Israel were given the law by God. They had a leg up. They had a mediated law. They were further ahead in that sense than the Greeks. But you can find some Greeks outperforming some Jews, even though they were given the law. So chapter 3, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Chapter 4, Abraham, God approaches him, and before he can do observances such as circumcision, the Lord looks at the reception of the relational invitation that he is putting forth in this outlandish promise that he gives Abraham unconditionally, saying, this is coming to you. Wrestles with that more in chapter 5, chapter 6. You have this whole illustration of death and law and life. It's a very complex little dance. I try to work through it. I've been, I've got, what, 39, 37, 35 videos on this already on my church channel. I go through it very slowly. Again, partly because we're dealing with real people. And the real people who can't come, who come to class, don't sit there and rewind the video if they really want to get the idea down. There's a lot of repetition. But we get to the point where, number one, we are not rescued by having a list of rules. Rules are good. Rules are awesome. You're better off having that law number two, those mediated rules, than not having them at all, because you can save yourself a whole lot of grief and a whole lot of foolishness by having some rules. But righteousness, this capacity to fulfill what the rules are really pointing to, the law under the law. I talked about this very famous commandment, you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Well, what's the spirit that's underneath that rule? This is where I'm really excited to, I don't know how much they're going to get to when you get into later weeks of this, when you, if how much they touch on Leviticus or, you know, some of the, some more of the code in Exodus or Deuteronomy for that matter. Because there's a spirit underneath the rule. And obviously, in Rabbinic Judaism, they have to sort of update the rules. And you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk winds up being a prohibition against cheese and meat together. And again, I don't look at that as some barbarism. Because again, misery, deliverance, gratitude. I'm a Calvinist, and some of the subtle difference that happens in the Protestant Reformation is Calvinism in many ways turns around and says the law is good, and the law can teach us to respond to the grace that God has extended to us through Jesus Christ by living obediently. So however you're going to cut up these rules, whether you want to have lots and lots of rules and have everything be very prohibitive, or if you're going to maximize freedom, let's say, the goal is not trying to navigate my life by a set of avoiding certain things so I don't get those punishments. It's not a bad thing. You should drive the speed limit in order to avoid tickets. It's all fine. But the main goal is grateful pursuit of the holiness of God. That's the goal. And given the myriad of complex situations in life, hopefully what your church and your church leaders and your Christian community should be doing is helping you on that way. And I don't know, I think YouTube videos hopefully certainly will be helpful for some of this. But that's the goal. And generally speaking, when it comes to the details of someone's life, maybe I'll end with this.
I was thinking of, you know, I was telling you all those wild stories about my youth, you know, my parents got divorced, and there's an interesting story about that I want to tell you. So, my dad was, he was in the Navy and stuff like that. And he always wore like khaki pants and a t-shirt and stuff. And so we were like, Dad, you need to get like a cowboy hat and jeans. And, we were trying to do a makeover on him and stuff like that. My life was full of pleasure. And, I was out there living life. And they were very 50s kind of people. And I have two brothers, and when we were all in college, he left my mom for another woman. Oh, wow. And only lately have I thought, I wonder if I had anything to do with like opening that Pandora's box, And I'm thinking now about the things about what you and Nick talked about, the idea of, I know that was a sibling, but I know a lot in our church, it's kids who, and their journeys that change the parents' ideas.
Yeah.
But I want to tell you what happened. I wrote a little bit about this, but this woman said in the thing that you just said in the Times that something like she couldn't live her full life if she was still married. And my father, who's very Catholic, said, I don't care if I go to hell. That's what he said. Okay. So he married this other woman, and it was a real, really contentious divorce. It was awful. My mother did not want to get divorced, but he moved on, and she was older, an older woman, so he didn't have other kids or anything. But I want to say maybe 8 years later or something like that, maybe it was 10 years later, he called and asked me, now I'm not a Catholic anymore, and he asked me, what do you think if I got an annulment? And I said, well.
From the second marriage?
From the first marriage, from my mother.
Oh, okay. And
they were divorced,
Okay.
So that he could marry his second wife in the church.
In the church.
So I said, so your kids are bastards? And he goes, no, it's not like that anymore, And I said, I think there are your rules, and I don't think you should, after 23 years of marriage and three kids, you should get an annulment. And I also didn't think that, it would be fair to put my mother through that thing. So it came in the family lore that I stopped them from getting an annulment. So, anyway, a couple years go by and he dies. And at the funeral, now, if you're a Catholic, you can't receive communion. He went to church. They went to church every Sunday. He was a reader, all kinds of stuff, but no communion. So, the Monsignor says to me, I don't know why, at the end, we got your father the communion. And I'm thinking, did he get a secret annulment? What happened? So my stepmother told me when I asked her, and it must have been a couple of years later, that they had agreed to live celibately in order to be received back into the communion with the Catholic Church. And most people would think that that was insane. Yeah. I don't tell many people.
Yeah.
But I was thinking about your conversation with Nick and this idea of seeking God, right? Because my church would go out of business if the Catholic Church allowed divorced people full communion. There would be no church.
I believe it.
Right? But why would you do that? Why would a person do that? And I read a little bit of Nick's comments, it's like the prodigal son and all that kind of stuff. And he was in the Catholic Church a prodigal son. But my stepmother said that he knew he was gonna die. And he died in the back of the church, getting ready to process up the aisle to read during Mass. And he had a coronary.
Oh my goodness.
He got in the back of the church, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So, would I do that? No, I didn't even go to that church.
Sorry, the mic was off. That's just such a powerful story. And again, okay, so this was a Catholic story. I have all these rules. Rules are fine. There's nothing wrong with rules. But what the story gets after is, you know, he divorces his wife. Should I get an annulment? Because that would sort of follow the rules. And she challenges him. What are you saying, that your first marriage didn't happen? Of course it happened. You had three kids. On what grounds are you going to get annulment? You know, are you going to say that we're, you know, we're the product of some of the postman or the milkman? No. So then he lives with his second wife, a celibate life, a chaste life, because he loves the church and he loves his God. And he might have at one point said, well, if I'm going to go to hell, I'm going to go to hell. I want to get out of this marriage. Okay. You did. Then obviously he and his second wife had an agreement, and they went to church every week because, and some will look at those rules and say, well, if he didn't have those stupid rules, he could have enjoyed sexual union with his second wife. Boy, the world is complex. And again, I don't want to have a YouTube channel that's all about building up the law. Anyway, I probably shouldn't even post this video. But I watched all these videos, and, you know, I'm glad the seminar is the structure it is and can look at the questions and listen to different people and bring in the conversation at a much deeper level than we're going to have a fight between atheists and Catholics and Protestants about and Jews about the rules. Okay, well, let's have a conversation about the rules, because rules are good. But rules aren't the goal. The goal of the Christian life is union with Christ.